listening to People Powered Radio, proudly supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. cbf.com.au.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Community Connections. I'm Alan Collier. It's my pleasure to be with you. It's time for the Legal Hour, and I have with me the Supremo from Hutchinson Legal, Grant. How are you, Grant?
I wouldn't call myself Supremo. I think that's a bit humble, that title.
And also have Sophia. How are you, Sophie?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Very well, thank you. It's good to have you. Now, prior to Christmas, we sent the people away with a question, and it's regarding, we see these cars that have been dumped on the side of the road, and the council put a notice on them and then cart them away. Now, we're not questioning that the council don't have the right. And normally I was actually contacted by a couple of people after the show last year and said, well, generally they always go through an auction and they're generally sold to wreckers so that they're wrecked and then there's no doubt about the ownership of the car. It doesn't even exist. However, we've got a person that raised the question, I believe he's done it. He went to one of these auctions and he bought an older car. But when we talk old, it's probably 50 years old or something like that, in quite disrepair. And now to do these cars up, there's a lot of time. You can spend 1,000 hours and still not get very far. And you can spend a lot of money. Now, what he doesn't want to do is pour all these hours in and 40 or 50,000 and then there's some doubt because he hasn't actually bought the car from the original owner. He's just bought it through the auction. He wants to know what the actual legal status of that car is. And I believe, Sophie, you've got the answer.
Right. So if it was possessed by the council, it depends whether it was registered or unregistered.
No, it'd be unregistered. They're dumped on the side of the road.
Unregistered. So usually the council will give the original owner 28 days. To make a claim for the vehicle.
But they can't find him. They don't know who it is.
That's right.
Yep.
So it belongs to the council. Once the council sells it off, ownership is transferred over to the new purchaser. So the council does take their investigations really seriously. Obviously, each council does it a bit differently. But the original owner has every chance and opportunity to make a claim for their vehicle.
What, during those 28 days?
During those 28 days, correct. Yep. So the council, once impounded, they will serve a notice of impounding on the owner. Every opportunity is given until it's transferred over and sold to its new owner.
So even though the council hasn't been able to get hold of the original owner, it's still deemed that they've done their best. So therefore, there's no right if the original owner sees that car at a car show or something, because you can identify cars through body numbers and engine numbers, and says, hey, that's my car. He can't then claim it back from the person who now owns that car and has spent all the money on it?
Right. So I would suggest if you have a vehicle that's been stolen, for example, or that's been impounded, first of all, notify the police. So then there's a record that that was your vehicle. Try to do everything possible to find your vehicle. But at the end of the day, every opportunity was given to you. So it rests with the new owner. What I would suggest, though, is before you purchase a vehicle, you do a search on what's called the Personal Property Security Register. So that will tell you if the vehicle is financed. If it is, there is a possibility that the financier will take the vehicle off you.
Yeah, now, in this case, we're talking old cars that wouldn't have any money on them, but it's mainly the person is really concerned that they're not going to spend all this money, do all the work, and then find someone says, that's my car, and I never sold it to you, so I want it back.
Right, yes. So, gone through the council, the investigations were done. It's with the new owner now.
Listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And welcome back to Community Connections for our Legal Hour with Grant and Sophie. And I should say, if you've got a question, we've already got a couple of questions to ask them, send them away with, but if you've got a question, give Greg a quick ring. He's sitting out there doing nothing in the office. 59-615-991. 59-615-991. Greg might not agree with that, but let's get him working, get some questions.
Yes.
Now, Grant, you want to talk about these e-scooters?
Well, I was thinking with Valentine's Day coming up and present, thinking of a present for your loved one. Well, have you ever thought of indulging in an e-scooter there, Alan?
No, I have not. No, I have not. Greg's got a couple of them.
Has he really?
No, okay. Absolutely.
Oh, well done. Well,
here he is. He even broke his wrist falling off one, but he's not going to tell you that.
I think Greg's here to defend his honour. So he's going to come in. So you've got an e-scooter, have you?
Or yeah, two? I've got a couple of them and an e-bike.
And an e-bike. Mm. Okay, well.
He's got plenty of money, Greg, so he can have whatever he likes.
So how far could an e-scooter get you? Would it get you to Lillito?
Oh, easily. I'm in Mount Evelyn. And I come along the Warby Trail to here. Wow. Takes less than half the battery, but I recharge it up here while I'm here and then ride back.
And he goes that hard, as I say, he fell off it.
Yeah, well, we've had a lawyer at our office who fell off as well. So have you had somebody try to put restraints on you now?
Apart from family, you know.
He's trying to look for some business here.
Now, do you wear a helmet?
Oh, yes. I started wearing a bike helmet, and after I fell off the first time, that was it. I've got a full-face BMX type.
And are you going to get a leather jacket soon?
No.
I think you could be like Fonzie.
He's going to have Greg Carrick across the back of his scooter club. Greg Carrick scooter club.
I think you could form a bit of a gang around these carts. I could see that.
Well, there's more and more of them. I'm seeing more and more all the time. And when I ride on the trail, more and more electric devices.
They're so cheap, aren't they?
But they can be, yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't know how good they are if they're really cheap, but I'm assuming you're only getting the top drawer stuff. So,
of course.
Oh, yes. Greg, have you got insurance on it?
No.
So Grant, what's your...
You'd want to
what would his legal liability be if he hits a pedestrian? Because this came up the other day.
Yeah, no, is this a question for next week or for today? No, I can do it today.
Because he might be game enough to ride it tomorrow.
No. I think it's fine. It's just like anything else. If you introduce a danger, where's he gone?
He left. He didn't want to hear.
So I think if you... So it just gets back to the simple concept of negligence. And that is, if you're... Do you owe a duty of care to other people sharing areas? And yes, you do. And have you breached that duty? Have you caused damage? And if so, you know, if there's a causation of between your actions, then there's a simple clause in negligence. I'd tell you what, I'd say interfering phones is the major danger around here.
This phone has been a pest. I'll get rid of it. all right, so let's expand that a bit, because I know this came up the other day on these e-scooters that are running around the city, and I see even some idiot went through the tunnel on it and all this sort of stuff. But, well, again, if you got skittled by one and it's gone, have you got any comeback on the e-scooter where you hired it from?
Now, I think this is very interesting because you know that the Melbourne City Council are making them available, a bit like they used to make bikes available. I think too many of those bikes found their way into the Yarra. So they've now got these e-scooters and they hope they won't find their way into the Yarra. So 20-kilometre limit is the maximum you're allowed to.
And the police are finding a lot out, aren't they?
Yeah, no, people don't. Well, I think these days you've got to do a little test online to show that you know what to do with these things before you're then issued with a permit to be able to hire one from the Melbourne City Council. But 20 kilometres, you're being charged around 45 cents a minute. That's not, doesn't sound that cheap to me, but maybe I'm a cheapskate.
what about the pedestrian who gets skittled by them?
Well, as I say, let's just make sure the pedestrian wasn't assuming a risk. Let's say the pedestrian was walking around aimlessly.
I'm just talking about walking down the footpath.
Yeah,
someone comes screaming down at over 20 k's there, hits him and keeps going. Could you go back?
Yeah, I think Sophie wants to say something.
I just ask one question. Could you then go back to whoever hired the e-bike or the e-scooter or what happens? Or it's just bad luck?
In terms of footpaths, e-scooters, at least in Melbourne, can't be on a footpath. So you'll usually see them on a low-speed road or a shared road. But in terms of who you go to, I'm assuming it would be the company that is that owns a scooter is if it's too difficult to find the actual individual riding it. But you won't see them on the footpath, hopefully.
Well, you are, because I saw them on TV the other night. They're everywhere you on the footpath. Yeah. They're probably 80% of what I saw are all on the footpath. None of them are on the road, other than the idiots that are going down through the tunnel. Well, see, someone will get killed in there.
I was down the peninsula and I saw a kid that had put two milk crates, you know, those plastic milk crates, light, and he'd stacked two of them, one on top of each other, obviously affixed it, and was sitting on it.
I mean, there's a recipe for disaster there somewhere, isn't there?
Well, just don't give Greg that idea. I don't want to see Greg coming along on one of those.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, Grant, I've been reading in the paper two or three times about a scam that's going on. I know somebody lost over $500,000 about it. Yep. They sold their house, put their money in the bank, bought another house. They got an email from their solicitor who said, well, we've done all the paperwork. It's time to hand over $500,000. So they did. And they said transfer to their bank account. And a few days later, they were talking to the legal people and they said, no, we haven't sent you a bill yet. So the $500,000's gone. So, I mean, what could you do in a case like that? Nothing, probably. It's probably in God knows where by now.
Yeah, it's a scam, and the money would be sent on very quickly, you know, via a couple of... So the scammers would have directed them to an account that they controlled, and then they would have transferred it on. So it's probably moved two or three times.
In two or three countries?
Yeah, and it's just a horrible scam that's going on. So I know at the bottom of our emails that we send out, it always says that, you know, there are people imitating, and so they can actually take an email and it looks authentic. Yep. And the address, if you look at the address that they've sent it from, all they've done is put a little full stop somewhere in it that's not meant
just
to be there.
Just
or a number or something that just... So you think you're dealing with the right person, accounts at wherever, but really you're dealing with somebody else. So, and it probably comes with the same warning on the bottom because they probably replicate our... Yeah, that's never happened for... It hasn't happened in our office. We've had some people try. Right. But you're right, if they contact without going through us, you can't really hold the person who's being... the person who's been defrauded, they would be looking for somebody to have a go at, and I imagine the first thing would be to report it to the police and seek to recover whatever they can.
Look, but that's not going to happen, is it? Look, you're not going to get it.
There have been cases when people have moved quickly, the money's been recovered within, or at least a substantial portion of it, right. So don't rule it out completely, but yeah, normally if you've left it two or three days, it's too late.
So if someone, like in a case like that where you're settling money, you really should ring, say it was absolutely your office, and I'm not going to put you in the frame, but if it was someone like yourself who sent him an email and requesting money, you should send money straight. You should ring.
Absolutely. You should ring and say, look, just wanting to confirm that this is the, you've sent an email to me and this is the money that you're after. So that's what we say in the bottom of our, if we request money from you, but normally it would be part of an ongoing discussion with the office. So always be careful.
Let's take that a bit further, and you want to talk about e-contracts. That looks to me like that could be a problem.
Well, you're already seeing online all sorts of things going wrong, and now there's talk about having smart legal contracts. A smart legal contract allows parties to securely automate the performance of their traditional contracts. So let me give you this example, Alan. So let's say you're importing bananas from what country? Where would you like to import bananas from?
Well, say I'll bring something from a third world country because that's...
You would say PNG.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
By the way, you don't say third world these days, so we say developing.
That's true, sorry.
And I think even developing is... but let's say PNG, you're importing your bananas and you know that... For the shells, you don't want all brown banana or black bananas.
Right.
So you say that they have to be shipped in a shipping container at this temperature. So not more than 18 degrees, not less than 16 or whatever it is that you put. So in the shipping container goes something that sends out a little advice into the computer world, into the ether out there, and and if something, if it goes wrong and it gets to the wrong temperature, if it's over, then that might cause either damages or a complete default, repudiation of the contract, and so it might lead to the contract being set aside. And so that is automated in, so there's something communicating to the computer, so it automates what's required. And under Section 15C of the Electronic Transfers Act, I believe, it's now you can have money transferred without human interference. So you've already set it up in the blockchain. So these things have already... And so now that works well in a what I'd call a very basic transaction. But as soon as a contract requires the word reasonable that you use... computers have trouble. You can just see, starting to... it's the little head of the robot starting to steam, and as it tries to work out what reasonable means. So artificial intelligence isn't quite there yet. You'd have to tell them reasonable is between these temperature gauges or reasonable temperature, or it's only allowed to be outside of that for... not more than an hour or something. I don't know. So all of these things are fascinating. And to think that things are already being hacked, but banks see the advantage in allowing these transactions to go online. So
what's the advantage, though, if there's a chance of people being defrauded? I don't see how that... Because the more you bring in, which is what we're talking about, I was talking about a very basic thing, which is what you and I are talking about, but now you're expanding into this e-contract, so basically everything's done in the ether. So surely there's a huge opportunity to hack it.
It's not happening yet. There will be opportunities for hacking, and so there'll have to be some safeguards put in place, but this is a new concept. What's worse is this. So let's say I bring in the bananas for you, and then you choose not to pay me.
Yep.
Well, that's not very good. So that's if the blockchain is set up, if I bring them in, I give you 2,000 bananas and they came in at this temperature, the money just comes out.
Yep.
I deliver them, it's done. So the blockchain can make sure that they, and obviously you can monitor the account to make sure the account always has money in it. So maybe there's a bank guarantee behind it, who knows. But
there normally is. We used to import stuff from overseas, and if it was $100,000, we had to make sure... Well, the banks used to put a stop on the last $100,000 in the bank account, so that... Because my understanding is when you import, you do it on letters of credit, and the letter of credit is banked. You have to guarantee it, but if you fall over, your bank has to guarantee it. And I'm told if something happened, your bank fell over, when you're doing letters of credit, the federal government have to actually support it.
Okay, but these blockchain contracts, so let's say you're importing bananas, but you're going to supply them, supply them to Wendy's, who are going to make banana splits and banana smoothies. Now, the data that there's been a default over here because the temperature was out of the range can not only be fed into your contract, can be fed into subsequent contracts. So it can be just a whole... they're talking about what's called oracles, which is oracles is things that basically know all the facts, and those things are a given, and you can't dispute those things. All I know is I think too often people try to avoid their obligations under contracts.
Yep.
It happens too often. Once is too often. It doesn't happen all the time. There is always some people you don't even need a written contract. They'll be good for their word.
Yep.
But if you have these, the blockchain, these smart, so they're called smart legal contracts. It's a new concept. It's coming. I wouldn't be scared of it. I just wouldn't get involved in it unless you...
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And welcome back to the Legal Hour. And so far, we haven't had a phone call. First of all, thank you to Leanne for the phone call. Really greatly appreciated. It's a great song, Leanne. And probably give it another fly I played it last Sunday, I think. But anyway, look, Greg's out there doing nothing. 59615991. You must have a legal question. Well, we're getting pretty tight for time now. So give us a ring really quick. Sophie, we've let you off the hook. You've just been sitting there listening to us ramble on. You want to talk about elder abuse?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a sad topic, obviously, but recent investigations found that 90% of elders are abused by family members or de facto partners, which is quite a big number.
Sorry, isn't that when it occurs 90% of the occurrences, not that 90%?
The sentiment do it.
Sorry, right, I don't want to be difficult.
When it happens,
yeah, right.
90% of the time it's by family members. And so,
but it can take all forms too, can't it? It's not just a person hitting the other person. I was just saying to Grant, I read a little while ago where some woman said to her mother, if you don't change your will and write my two brothers out of it, you'll never see my grandchildren ever again. And it broke the mother's heart. So
right. That
would be declared as abuse too, wouldn't it?
It would, yes. So there's all kinds of abuse. It's not just physical. There's also emotional abuse. Neglect can count as abuse, as well as financial. We see a lot of financial abuse of elderly clients. Abandonment, for example, can also be abuse. So it's not just hitting someone that counts as abuse. We recommend the most important thing to do, obviously, is if you're in danger, to call 000. And the next step to take would be to get what's called an intervention order, which would protect you from the offender. Now, there's a lot of steps you can take, and particularly with COVID time, you can do it online. You Google intervention order, you fill in a form, you're then contacted by the registry team who talks you through the process of an intervention order. What an intervention order does is it allows you to pick a list of conditions that you can protect yourself with. An example is the offender is not allowed to damage your property. They can't locate you or follow you. They can't publish material about you online, communicate with you, or approach you within a certain distance. So it's a wide range of clauses and conditions that the respondent or the offender can't do to you, which is why they're very sought after.
The police will act on those, will they? If the perpetrator turns up at your house, then you...
If an order is made, once the order is made, and there's a breach to the conditions in your order. Every order is different. Every condition is different. It depends on the case that you're dealing with. But if there's a breach to any of your conditions, definitely call the police. The police will take action ranging from charging the perpetrator to imprisonment.
Sophie, we'd like you to write this down and someone to come back with some questions next week. Next month.
Poor old
Grant nearly fainted when he thought they'd come back this week. We want to know what the law states, and it's not a macabre subject, really, because it's got a few ramifications. How many people can be buried in a grave? Not what a cemetery's rules might be, what the actual law says. Because I can't imagine you could have 10 people and dig down 80 feet and keep burying them. We want to know legally how many people would be allowed in a grave, because there's husband and wife and sometimes there's children. That's the question we got from a listener. Now, I don't use my examples to anyone and normally, but I just want to quickly explain. I had a friend of mine. He was married to a lovely lady for about 30 years. They had 3 or 4 children and she got cancer and died. A few years later, he remarried. Now, when he met the new wife, he said, look, I have an agreement with my first wife that we will both be buried together. So that's the way it's going to be. I'm sorry, but if you marry me, that's the way it's going to be. And she accepted that and it went well. What would happen in that case if his children said, no, you married someone else. We want to know, have the children got the right to say no? We don't want dad in with mum because you went off and married someone else. Or in this case, what happens if he hadn't made that agreement with his first wife? So he's going to be buried with his second wife, but her children, because she'd been married and her husband had died of cancer, what rights of her children to say, no, we don't want you being buried with our mum. We want our mum to be buried with dad. So we want to know, first of all, how many people are allowed in a grave, but more importantly, who makes the decisions as to who goes in the grave? Now, I don't think it's going to be all that simple, because there will have to be a law somewhere. And then we'll take it one step further. If in the case of those two that I've just mentioned to you, where either the children from the first wife said, no, buzz off, we don't want you in with mum because you're remarried, or he said, yeah, I'll go with the second wife, and her kid said no. First of all, have they got the right to make that decision? And secondly, who can challenge that decision and where would you challenge it to? Maybe it's a magistrate's court. I don't know. I think that's going to take a bit to look up, to be honest with you, because cemeteries might have rules, but at the end of the day, some of these things could get right down to what the actual law says. So could you get somebody to have a look at all those instances, please?
Of course, yes.
Grant, well, let's get back. You were keen. We were talking about the elder abuse.
Yes.
And I told you the example I'd read about where this lady was pressured to change her will.
Yep.
So you're saying there are other things that can happen.
Well, if somebody has... clearly, you need to have to be able to express your views and not be coerced by somebody else. So if you could prove coercion on the part of the will maker, that is that they were coerced by somebody and the threat that you won't see your grandchildren or something unless you do this... It would go to the question of the validity of the will. Was that person of their own free will making that will?
Who would have to prove that?
Say the person challenging the will. So you'd start with, in the first instance, that the will, if the will's being put forward by the executor named in that will, then that executor would seek to say that that will's valid for these reasons. And if somebody was wanting to say, well, look, I know, because Mum wrote to me at the time and said, look, I'm doing this, but I'm only doing it under pressure. You would hope that the lawyer or the person supervising the execution of the will would realise that there was coercion, and that coercion, that would therefore be taken into account. And so then children might be treated the same. It may be treated as a non-valid will, and then you go back to what's called the laws of intestacy. The law of intestacy is what happens if there is no will. You're looking curious. You're looking like... Oh, I'm going to keep talking. And, I just wanted to let you know about... So that's one thing to deal with in terms of wills. Can you think of anything... But dealing with how many people can get into the grave, that's interesting. So we'll be ready next month to tell you about that. Of course, Ellen, as you know, it's the platinum anniversary for Her Majesty the Queen, and I imagine you should be standing when we talk about the Queen, but...
Absolutely. Coming up, what's it? 70 years is a terrific time, isn't it?
It is. It's a time. It's really provided some stability in the midst of constant change with our elected officials.
Yep.
And it's one of the things that is the basis. So many things happen in our legal system based on Her Majesty the Queen. So yep. The Crown versus so-and-so. So it's often things, if it's a crime against the state, it's often in the name of... the Queen.
Queen, yeah.
Making a charge. As I remember a writ that was shown to me, and I hope I'm not the Mr. Dixon. He showed... No, this is true. It was a case where somebody was suing two other drivers, and the surnames were Quick and Swift. So the two people... So we've still got that writ around the office, but that's a genuine Supreme Court writ back in the old days when you would sue on...
So if we're talking about, and I'm not going to get into the Republic and all that, I don't want to get into debate about that.
I wouldn't have even raised it if I...
Well, yes, I did. The only reason I want to raise it is because you said that some of these legals are in the name of the Queen.
Yes.
So if the country became a Republic,
yeah,
then who would you be suing? Were you saying you sue in the name of the Queen? Who would you sue in the name of?
I don't know. I haven't seen what they do in America. Is it the President? So there's always... The Westminster tradition has three arms of government: the executive, the judiciary, and the legislative. So
yep.
The Parliament makes the laws, the state enforces the laws, and the courts interpret the laws. So,
yep.
And the idea is, one should never talk to the other. There should always be separation.
So, and there should be, shouldn't there?
Absolutely. Yeah. So you would have, if we don't have the Queen, who's the executive, the head of the executive, then there'd be somebody else that would be in that place. So,
and that's one of the reasons, am I right, why you can't sack a judge, isn't it? Like a judge can only retire or gets retired at 75 or something.
Yeah, it shouldn't be a politician saying, let's get rid of this. Let's get rid of this. Of course, in some countries, judges are elected.
Yep.
And we've chosen not to go that way because we want them to not be listening to the populace, because we already have protests outside courts.
Yep.
Just think what it would be like if it wasn't really just... if people felt that they could vote or against a judge based on whether they'd been harsh.
You could put the pressure, couldn't you?
That's why so many people are in jail in the US, because judges are constantly required to prove how tough they are. because to get re-elected, they have to show that they're the toughest judge.
Yeah.
And so if you want more people in prison,
the judges.
Well, go back to England in the when steal a handkerchief and.
And you wind up in Australia.
Well, now that's a fantastic deal. Let's go back to that.
Thanks for being with us today. And we look forward to having you back with us again.